Well, the hater's gonna hate, 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 hate. And the faker's gonna fake, 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 baby. I'm just gonna make, 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 make. Making luck, making luck.
A Dominion Podcast!
Yeah, I mean, I think I got what that was. I think that...
That's a little more iconic.
I think that the time when that could have been described as iconic has passed.
I'm like sorry.
5 years.
Alright, well, at least you only said five.
Yeah.
The show's been on for 20 years.
I mean, I believe you. So, if you haven't figured it out, Adam is living out one of his life dreams.
Welcome to Making Luck.
A Dominion podcast. And not just the podcast dream. Like, he has another dream that he's living out at the moment, which is why this is a mini-show.
Yeah. So, I've been wanting to go on Survivor for most of the time the show's been on. I applied to the CBS show. It's a reality TV show. I applied to the show for like 6 years. They never called me back. I think I would make excellent television. But, you know, Jeff Probst, I guess, has better things to do. I think I'm just not attractive enough to get on the show. Anyway, I stopped applying to that, but there are some fan-run games that are done live, and I applied to one of those. I was cast, and if you're listening to this right now, and it's not, like, years in the future, I'm playing that game right now. I'm in the woods in northern Tennessee.
He has probably been eaten by a coyote.
Yeah. I'm definitely being eaten by a lot of bugs. Mostly ticks from what I've heard about this location.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I'm going to be...
Are you going to, like, get Lyme disease from this?
Maybe.
All right.
This is bucket list material. Like, I applied, like, 8 months ago. Interviews. Yeah. I was cast, like, 5 months ago. Maybe 6 months ago, and like I've been preparing for this. I went and learned how to make fire. I hate camping, but I've been learning how to do that.
Yeah.
And I've been brushing up on my survivor skills. And I mean, this is a dream of mine, and so that's more important than the podcast, which is why it's why this is a mini-sode, but also why this is being published when it is, because I'm having this scheduled to be published right about when the game starts. And so you can actually follow that game, if you want to support me or watch what's going on. A lot of the important things, challenges, confessionals, tribal councils, all that stuff will be live streamed on the Facebook page. So the game is called Surviving Real Foot. Real Foot, R-E-E-L-F-O-O-T. It's the name of the national park nearby where a lot of these seasons were filmed. You can go to their Facebook page, Surviving Real Foot, and you can follow that Facebook page. And if you're my friend on Facebook, there will be statuses and links scheduled to be posted around the time when the game starts. The game is 8 days long, and you know, there'll be I think 20 people playing the game. I'm gonna do the best I can. I'm gonna try and win. Let's be honest. I'm probably gonna lose. I'm probably gonna get a lot of people to hate me in the process, but I am gonna be good television.
That's I believe it. I'll be looking forward to watching it.
Yeah, Jake's he's gonna tell me now that he's gonna watch it, and I believe him. I believe he's gonna watch it. But I would appreciate.
Yeah.
And that's fine. Actually, yeah, no, I will. They're a little bit difficult to watch live because there's a lot of like standing around waiting for things to happen, and it's nice when you can skip ahead to that.
Yeah.
But in any case, you can follow. You can cheer for your favorite person. Whether that's me or someone else, I completely understand if you don't want to root for me.
He does not.
Really?
Yeah, he's going to hold it against you.
Interesting. Maybe I'll hold it against you. We'll see when we get there.
Yeah.
But anyway, we hope you enjoy the podcast. It's a Q&A episode. The following episode will hopefully be published on schedule, but I can't promise that. I'm going to be driving back on a Sunday. We record things on Monday. I may have to physically recover. Maybe something exploded while I was gone.
Probably got eaten by a coyote.
Probably got eaten by a coyote.
Yeah.
So maybe it'll be a day or two late, but I'll do my best. Maybe Jake will have quit Dominion in the podcast by that point. You never know.
Maybe I'll have been eaten by a coyote.
Yeah. Stranger things have happened.
Yeah.
But in any case, I encourage you to follow that if you're interested. And maybe listen to this podcast, because we've got some cool questions and some neato answers.
Yeah.
So the question here is, what's your favorite paradigm, and why? I don't really have a favorite paradigm. To me, there's a couple things. So first of all, the actual matchup is generally more important to how much I enjoy a game than what paradigm I'm playing or what paradigm my opponent is playing. So for one thing, mirrors tend to be less interesting than non-mirrors. I could go into a lot of reasons for that. This question could probably be a whole show, but there's that. But also in terms of paradigms, there's some other things going on. Typically what makes things interesting to me is, are there difficult decisions to make? And do those decisions have some realistic, reasonable impact on the game, right? So a decision that would not be, you know, important or reasonable to the game would be, like, impactful. Basically, the kind of decision that I don't care about would be, like, oh, I have a 5-2 in turn one with shelters. Like, do I buy an estate with my shelter because I have the hovel in hand and there's some trashing, so I'm almost certainly going to trash either the estate or the hovel before I would do anything else with it anyway. So it's almost exclusively just about, do I lower the estate pile by one or not? Yes, that probably has some kind of an impact on the game, but turn one, turn two, it's so unclear that whichever decision you make or not, yes, it's probably not an absolutely pointless zero decision, but it's so close to that, that's not the kind of decision I'm talking about. So what kinds of decision am I talking about? I mean, that's also kind of tricky because there's so many different kinds of games and different kinds of decks. But basically, paradigm-wise, one thing that helps a lot is if it's a paradigm that isn't very common. So, yeah, you draw your whole deck using villages and smithies, and then you add payload while keeping your draw up. And that's good, and actually that provides for a lot of decisions because, like, how much do you need? What's the best way to augment your payload? How much do you need to keep adding drawing stuff to your payload? How much do you, or to your deck, to as your deck size increases as you add payload? How much do you hedge on making sure you're super reliable versus being able to spike as much as possible? And that often depends on what your opponent is doing and how far you're ahead or behind and things like that. So there's a lot of interesting decisions in that kind of paradigm in a lot of cases. So that's good. But at the same time, if every game is doing that, and a lot of games are, that kind of makes it less interesting in some ways because the games tend to be a little bit samey. Obviously, within that paradigm, there's so many little decisions that oftentimes it's still really interesting. But in general, I probably like it less than most people because it's a little bit samey to me. Whereas, let's say you're playing a money paradigm and there's a few different options at different price points, and you have to juggle your terminal space and how you want to deal with that, and, you know, when you start greening and all of that. And a lot of people don't like that very much, and maybe there's a little bit less decision making in terms of playing around pile endings and whatever compared to your opponent. So overall, it's maybe somewhat less interesting, I would say, but I maybe find it more interesting, at least proportionally to other people, overall, because it's so much less common. People think I like slogs a lot. Slogs I like mostly because they're different, and they have those kinds of still, they have some subtle decisions. And like when we're talking about money games or a slog, I think the decisions are, you know, it's 2% here and 4% there, but there's enough of them that adding up, they still make a big difference. If I look at my stats overall in, say, games with zero villages, which isn't exactly synonymous with money games, but it's vaguely similar anyway. Like I win a huge percentage of those games, 72%, and I don't say that to say, "Ha, I'm so good at them." I say that to mean if I'm able to do that well consistently, that means there must really be decisions that aren't trivial, because I'm sure I don't make them optimally. But my point is, though, there are impactful decisions to make, and they're not easy to make. And that's what I'm really looking for. But I think like rebuild is a separate paradigm, and this is the last point I'm going to make here. And I think it's more interesting than most people think, but there's also some detractions to it, particularly if it shows up very much. It itself, that rebuild paradigm, tends to be pretty samey with itself. So yes, there's some decisions, and it's not exactly trivial, and it's probably less trivial than people think, but it's pretty samey. And that's what I tend to like to avoid.
What is a blind spot you see a lot of other players having? I think it depends who you're talking about, because I have like just taken different online alts and leveled them up the leaderboard, so I feel like I have a good view of like the player base as a whole at various skill levels. At the higher end of the ladder, I think like the biggest blind spot I see really good players do is they like fixate on what the most powerful and efficient deck could be if they had an infinite amount of time to build it without thinking about their ability to like get half of the VP or some of the VP and then end the game. And don't get me wrong, these are very good players, but when they do screw up, I think it's on the side of erring away from speed to ending the game. And I'd see, for the more, I'd say, mediocre or like lower skill level of things, people who are newer to the game, I'd say, just less experience, I think that the blind spot would be like shuffle awareness. I see a lot of people like will play like a Wishing Well or a Pearl Diver for like no real benefit, like they didn't really need to draw that card, but they cause a shuffle. And now all their good cards are out in front of them, and they all miss the shuffle. So, don't get me wrong. Sometimes causing the shuffle is a good thing, but just like having that little alarm go off in your head when you're about to shuffle to make sure you're doing stuff right or that you actually want to do it, it's a good instinct to have. The biggest blind spot I'd say across like the whole player base comes back to earlier when I was talking about people relying on heuristics and relying too much on things they've learned from other games to influence how they play this game, and not really thinking critically about the board.
What do you like better, playing online or IRL? So I do play more online than IRL, and that's mostly a matter of convenience. It's easier for me to play with other people without actually making the effort to be there physically in person. However, I do like playing IRL a lot more. Most of that stems from the fact that I don't like sitting in front of a computer. I do that at work all day, so when I go home and I sit in front of a computer, even if I'm doing something I like, it still kind of feels like work to me. So, I mean, I do like playing IRL more.
What do you like pl better, playing online or IRL? I definitely like playing online better than playing IRL. I don't have to shuffle. I don't have to cut a randomizer. I don't have to get cards out. I like playing fairly competitively, I guess. And at this point, just based on how my life has gone, I don't have that many people to play with, particularly in a very into the game way, IRL. So definitely online.
Trivial Knot asks, how can we estimate the number of turns a game will last, and is it important to do that? I think that you can actually estimate the number of turns a game would last, and you can't, and it's important to the same degree that you can actually do it, which is to say that you need to put an asterisk by it. Understand that like a money-ish, like let's say a money mirror, like both people are just playing vanilla big money and both like going for provinces, you can understand that that's going to last like 18 turns ish or something like that. Why is that information useful to you? It's kind of a not, because you're not playing like solitaire, Against a real opponent, though, it's good for, like, evaluating how efficient your strategy actually was. It's good for, like, let's say you think this interaction is really strong. It's good for, like, getting a base speed of, like, well, how fast can this end the game if it has its druthers? Things like that. So, getting a good baseline of efficiency.
How can we estimate the number of turns a game will last, and is it important to do so? So I don't think it's really important to estimate the number of turns a game will last. And I think it's actually very hard to do so because you don't know what your opponent's going to do. But having said that, I think what this question is getting at is, well, I don't know if important is exactly the word I would use, but I think useful. And that's this kind of amorphous concept of understanding the speed of the game. And I think you can do something there. It's going to be contingent on what your opponent does, but you can make some suppositions about, you know, these are the few most likely options they're going to do, and in each of the cases, here's how it might end up. But in terms of the speed of the game, I think you can think to yourself, like, okay, let's say I've determined that one of the strategies maybe I want to go for here is to build a deck where I'm getting to the point where I'm drawing my deck, and then I'm going to build up my payload from there. And so you can think through what it's going to take you to get to the point where you're building your deck. So you're going to say, well, I'm going to get a chapel, and I'm going to get a silver, and you can work through kind of your buys and your trashes, and roughly get within usually a turn or two. And two turns might be a big variance here, but you can usually get pretty quickly, like, I'm going to trash this many turns, this many cards this turn, and then this many cards this turn, and this many cards this turn, and I'm going to get this many villages and this many smithies, and I'm going to have this payload. And you're going to say, by turn 8, I'm going to have 2 villages and a smithy. I'm going to be drawing my deck, and I'm going to have 4 money in it. And then you can think, okay, by the time I get to that point, how long does it take me to build up the payload? And go from there. And right, like, villages and smithy is not often the way it goes, but you really can, in a lot of cases, get reasonably well along the road of figuring out kind of where you're going to be at what point in time. If you're playing a money deck, like, you can see that, like, my average money is going to get me, I'm going to go silver, and then I'm going to have a 4 and a 5. And then on the next shuffle, I'm going to have a couple more 5s or a 6 and a 5 or, you know, whatever. And you can work through, and, like, it's about this point I'm going to start maybe being able to go for provinces and all of that. And then the trickiest thing for all of this, though, is when you're interacting with your opponent. So attacks tend to mess this up a bit because you don't know how fast or how hard you're going to get attacked. Necessarily, and particularly in a lot of cases, in some cases, the exact money composition might be very important. You know, spiking 7 early versus late, spiking 6 early versus late if you're going to get an altar, but spiking 7 if you're going to get an inheritance or something, right? That might be something that isn't as predictable as, like, I'm going to get my 5 and I'm going to get another 3 and it all works out because it's going to be fairly reliable to do that. Some cases it's less reliable, and that's going to throw you off by maybe a full shuffle almost sometimes, right? Shuffle luck is important. You know, dudding, how often do you dud? There might be some big variance there. But also the interaction. So if they militia you on a particularly important turn, like they militia you on your chapel turn, that's so much more impactful in many cases than militiaing you on another turn. So that's going to have a big difference, right? And so it gets harder to do at that point. And particularly the more complex it gets like that, it starts to get a lot harder to work out, you know, how the draws line up for the whole game. And so typically, in a lot of cases, what you end up doing is you set kind of a sub-goal or the next thing I want to be able to do is to get to this point. So maybe it's to where I'm drawing my deck. Maybe it's where I get some key 5er or 6 cost card or some big attack, or I'm able to play that attack reliably or something like that. and you can roughly figure out, it's going to take me about this long to get there. And that's like a good stopping point, because no matter what I want to do after it, you're pretty confident that that's what you're going to do there. So you kind of set a sub-goal, and you figure out roughly what it's going to take you to get that far, while also keeping in mind that how fast your opponent gets to their sub-goals is also important. So you might do something that's one turn slower for you if it's going to be three turns slower for them. It gets really complicated, but you can math out to some extent, and particularly the less interaction there is, the kind of pace at which shuffles go.
What about Dominion gameplay sustained your interest over the long term? So there are two kind of components of that. The first one is the mechanics of the game, right? I enjoy a lot of them. Particularly, I like the idea of finding cards that have synergies and putting them together. I enjoy that mechanic. But really, it's about the strategic depth that the game offers. I feel like I've played it for so long, and there's still such a huge opportunity to get better. There's so much room to get better. I believe that even the best players in the world still have a lot of room to get better at the game. And even after all this time, I can try and figure things out as much as possible. But as much as I've played the game, it still feels like I'm being creative when I'm finding some uniquely good decks to build. So with a lot of other games, you might find yourself just kind of going through the motions and, oh, well, this is good, I'm going to do it, blah, blah, blah. And it feels solved and boring. And Dominion just never has gotten there to me. I feel like there's a lot of area for improvement, and I feel creative when I do good things.
If you could be any color, what color would you be and why? This is interesting. Realistically, I would need to choose a flesh tone so that I could continue to operate without drawing any unnecessary attention.
If you could be any color, what color would you be and why? I would be red, and simply that's just because I want to look good.
For the non-native speakers, what does OP mean? Yeah, so OP is just an abbreviation for overpowered. But the other thing I will mention along with this question is that probably usually, we're saying it at least tongue-in-cheek, at least slightly sarcastically when we use OP, because it's kind of notorious on the internet that people, like for other card games, they're prone to a bit of hyperbole. So they say something is overpowered in an exaggerating way. So often it's a bit tongue-in-cheek when we say it, too. So, like, we say that Smithy is OP, and it's not really overpowered. It's just very good. But colloquially, people say anything that's good is OP, because it's overpowered. So it's usually a little bit joking, but, yeah, it means overpowered or strong.
Can you give an exact definition of what you mean by payload? Virtual money is the obvious thing, but sometimes it seems that you also mean plus cards or even attacks. So before I talk about the precise definition of payload, which actually hasn't been talked about on the podcast, so this is a useful time to do it, I want to actually point at something. I'm not even sure the person asking the question meant this, but I hear this a lot about virtual money. Virtual money isn't inherently better than other money. Virtual money is money that you get in your action phase, usually from action cards. That's not better than getting money from treasures. Like, it's all money, right? So if I don't care about the buy, I should get a silver instead of a woodcutter, because maybe I could, spend the action on something else, right? The woodcutter's not better just because it's virtual money. The woodcutter's better because maybe I care about the buy. That's why. Now, there are certain situations where you do care about virtual money. A lot of them are draw to X, or maybe like a tactician deck or something. Sometimes you have a specific synergy that wants you to have virtual money or virtual payload, money or payload that you get in your action phase and as opposed to your buy phase. Now, in those cases, sure, the virtual money is better, and maybe it matters that you have that kind of virtual money or virtual payload. However, in the absence of that, unless you have something specific that drives you towards that direction, it doesn't matter. And if it doesn't matter, in many cases, it's easier to get treasure payload than it is other forms of payload. Maybe it's not, but just virtual or non-virtual is not something that enters into the equation. It isn't important in that regard. But let's talk about payload. So my definition of payload is actually just anything that isn't deck control. So I'm going to define deck control and then say, all the card effects that are not deck control are just payload. Conceptually, deck control is stuff that helps you play cards. And payload is stuff you do that helps you win the game. So if I'm looking at effects that cards give me, I either classify them as payload or deck control. So what are deck control effects? Deck control effects are effects that give you either plus actions or villager tokens, or they are effects that give you ways to move your cards around while they're still yours. What does that mean? Most of the time it means drawing cards, but because you're moving them from your deck into your hand. Sometimes it means discarding cards, like maybe discarding from hand is like a negative deck control effect, or like moving them from your deck to your discard, like that's potentially deck control. Or maybe moving something to my island mat, right? That's a deck control effect. So all of that kind of stuff is included. Also, deck control includes when cards become yours and when they stop being yours. So normally when cards become yours happens when you gain them, but also like, oh, maybe you exchanged something or maybe you passed it with Masquerade or whatever. So it includes all of that. When a card is yours, that's a deck control thing. And then also when it's not yours, which is usually trashing, but also exchanging and passing and stuff. So when I gain a card, it becomes mine. And now that the card is mine, I have to worry about drawing that card. And that's the deck control concern. I call it the deck control concern because whenever I add a card to my deck, I have to think about, okay, am I okay drawing that card? Is it going to be a problem for me to draw that card? And so there's a valuable lesson there about cantrips, right? The things that give you at least plus one card and plus one action, drawing those cards is not hard because you play them and then they just replace the card and the action that it took. So those are kind of deck control neutral at least, or maybe positive if they have other effects, or negative if they have other negative deck control effects. However, there's a valuable lesson about the deck control concern there. So if I add a silver to my deck, I have to think about drawing that silver. And then similar thing with trashing cards. So then this is the entirety of deck control effects. Other effects that cards give you are payload. So for example, money and buys and gaining cards and playing attacks. Those are all considered payload. So there are a couple of interesting little bits about this definition. I've defined it this way, very intentionally, and other people may not do it exactly the same way, but man, I think this definition is really instructive because you can look at things like this and you can learn about the game. So playing attack cards. If I play an attack card, playing that attack is payload, right? However, a lot of attacks will have effects on your opponents that are related to their deck control. I play a militia, they have to discard cards. I play a witch, they gain a curse. That's a deck control concern, right? In fact, most attacks negatively affect your opponent's deck control. And so, while that is still payload, and you can consider the payload of your deck as including those attacks, I may choose to prioritize that attack in a similar way to me prioritizing my own deck control, even though it's payload. So when it comes to actually thinking about what's important in a real game of Dominion, payload and deck control isn't the entire story, but it can help you classify what cards are doing for you. It, kind of in a similar way to if I would buy a silver, which is a payload card, in order to actually hit five so I can buy the trasher or junker that I really care about. I prioritize that silver the same way I would prioritize the thinning or the junking, which is very high. Even though it's a silver and it's a payload card, and otherwise I would prioritize that a lot lower, the fact that I need that in order to get my deck control card, that matters more to me at the start of the game, and so I prioritize it that way. The other funny thing is I mentioned that gaining cards is payload, right? You know, money and buys are payload, buying cards is payload, but also gaining cards, payload, right? But then I said when a card becomes yours, it's deck control. Well, almost always when you gain a card, it becomes yours, right? So why is this distinction here? So when I buy a card, being able to do that, you know, that's payload. And normally I care about that because I could buy point cards, right? Because that helps me win the game. Or maybe other cards that help. However, when the card becomes mine, there's the deck control concern and I have to draw it. So even though, you know, when I gain a card, it's payload, when I'm choosing what card I have to gain, that may be educated by the deck control concern that comes with it. A card doesn't have to be all payload. It doesn't have to be all deck control. Market's a great example. The card and the action are deck control, but the money and the buy are payload. And it's okay for cards to have components of both, but some cards maybe don't. Like silver, if I'm thinking about, well, do I want to add a market or a silver to my deck? Well, if I care about getting that extra dollar that silver gives me and I'm able to draw it and I don't care about the buy, then sure, silver's better. But if I'm worried about drawing cards and maybe I care about the buy, then the market might be a better card for my deck. So you can look at payload and deck control and use that to help you evaluate, you know, what cards are going to be good for my deck, what am I looking for, and how can I identify the cards that fill the roles that my deck needs right now.
Air Flutter asks about the online client in particular. Would you change the way that kingdoms are rolled? Would it be better to choose a few expansions at random for each game and choose the kingdom just from those sets? Or so that you would get more of those like inner expansion interactions? Would it be better if you have like horizontal things come up as much or come up more often or always have two? Would you alter the kingdom design process for random games? I would not. The thing is, what you're talking about with sets having a lot of baked-in synergy with each other is by design, and it is really neat for people who don't play all that often. And when they do play, they play with one or two sets at a time, either because they don't own all the sets or because they keep them in individual boxes, stuff like that. But if playtesting sets has taught me anything, and playing in tournaments that have like set restrictions has taught me anything, it's that seeing the same combos in interactions over and over that are baked in together, it gets really samey and boring. You start to feel like you're playing the same game over and over again. Whereas with these full randoms, sometimes you discover things that are completely out of left field that the designer of the game didn't even think about that have synergies. Other times, you know, you just see these synergies and interactions seldom enough that they actually feel unique and interesting. As far as changing the other facets, like let's say you add a ban list or allow more than two landscape cards, things like that, I'm ambivalent. The ladder format is what it is, and like a competitive format just has you deal with it on its own terms. Right now, the competitive Dominion format for online play is you play full random, and any card can come up except for possession, and there are between zero and two landscape cards. Could it be different? Sure. Should it be different? I don't care.
How can we get worse at Dominion? The first several times I read this question, I didn't really understand, and I keep reading it and thinking, why do you want to get worse at Dominion? But I think it might be asking like ways in which you might get worse without realizing it. And I think the biggest threat there is to stop thinking, basically. So either you just play like on autopilot, remote, robot-y, like I've done this so many times before. I'm just going to do this. I'm going to go by pure feel and I'm not going to think about it. Or similarly, if you just start playing like groupthinky, like, oh, lots of all the other good players, like those people on the podcast, whatever, they would do this, so I'm just going to do that. But like, if you stop thinking for yourself, that's when you start to get worse, I think. Which isn't to say don't listen to other people and don't use your experience to help inform you, but use it to help inform your thought process, not to take over and replace your thought process.
Okay, we actually had two people ask sort of a similar question. RTT asks, if you could change one card, what would it be, and how would you change it? And Jez from our Discord asks, do you think any cards are either overpowered or underpowered? And those are different questions. I'm kind of going to answer them in the same breath here. And there are a few cards I would change a little bit. In the past, people have talked about a version of Cultist that is tweaked so that it either gives out the junk or it for free plays another Cultist. So it's either a terminal action that gives out the junk or it chains to play an extra Cultist but doesn't do both. Donald X has also said that he likes that version of Cultist as an idea, and I think I would rather play with that version of Cultist than the one we have now. I also, in the same vein, would like for Scrying Pool to get a similar nerf so that it could either make Scrying Pool terminal, I think that would be reasonable, or make Scrying Pool draw a max of one or two extra cards, so it can like be a lab or a super lab, but like doesn't like chain to like draw like eight or whatever, to make it like a little less mandatory to go for. Other than that, I think Tournament could be a more interesting card if every player got their own stack of tournament prizes that they could draw from, so it's not like there's one princess, and if I get the princess, you can't have it. It'd be more interesting if it's like we have this pool of prizes that we can all get. We could all get our own princess if we want, and the decisions we'd make would be like what order we get these prizes in, and that would take a lot of the interesting parts of Tournament and bring them to the forefront, the parts of like, oh, which prize do I want? Not which prize do I want to deny my opponent, which prize is good for me right now? And also, the aspect of revealing to get province, you know, risk-reward, that kind of thing.
What's your take on using the VP counter? Doesn't this change the game a whole lot? Would you aim for a 3-pile ending without knowing the exact standing? So there are three questions here. The third one is different from the first two, so I'll answer that one first. Would you aim for a 3-pile ending without knowing the exact standing? Now, if I'm doing my job playing IRL, even without a point counter, I should know where I stand. There shouldn't really be much mystery to it. So, this is still not really going to come up super often without a point counter. On the other hand, you know, sometimes it can be really hard to track things, and I'm not going to demand that my opponent constantly count their draw pile so I can know exactly how much their gardens are worth, right? So, I mean, I'm not going to be able to track everything, and I'm not going to know the status of every single point in the game. However, I can see situations where I would go for a 3-pile, despite not knowing the exact standings. Normally, it would be like, well, the way I win this game is by ending it as quickly as possible. So, yeah, I'm just going to end the game as quickly as possible and hope when we count the points that I did it fast enough and they didn't overtake me. I'm not going to play around that situation where, like, oh, well, they've overtaken me in points, so I'm not going to end the game on a loss, but I'm going to hopefully somehow win. Like, you know, that doesn't ever happen. That's just people try-harding and prolonging games. I'm not going to do that really ever. So, like, when I can't track things, I'm not going to attempt to make a play like that. I have better things to use my cycles on. The other two questions, how do I feel about the VP counter? It definitely does change the game a lot. I mean, yes, if everyone's doing their job, they all know the score, right? And so, in theory, it doesn't change the game, and maybe mechanically it doesn't change the game. But man, you play a game without point counter, with keep in it, and that is a completely different mental experience. And those games do play completely differently. That's definitely a thing. I prefer not using the point counter, and that has always been the case. That's just the way the game was designed. I find it to be more fun. I enjoy that more. However, you're going to see in all my videos that the point counter is on, and that's because for someone who's watching the game, The point counter is pretty much required in order to have a good viewing experience. And so if I'm going to make a video or stream or anything like that, I'm going to have the point counter on because the viewers need it, basically. And if it's going to be visible to the viewers, it might as well be visible to me. So that's why I do it. It's not my favorite thing. I don't think it's a big enough deal to like try and shut point counter off and do something or try and make it visible to the viewers and not me. I don't think it matters that much. But I definitely prefer no point counter.
Why do you think four-player games are so unattractive? Well, first of all, I don't think four-player games are unattractive. I think probably many more people play four-player games than play two-player games. So Now, the people who play two-player games play probably more games per person than the people who play four-player games. So, at least arguably, I guess I'm saying, I think four-player games are more attractive or popular anyway than two-player games. So that's the first thing, is I think they may well be more attractive. But people who don't like four-player games, I think there's a few reasons why they don't like it. First of all, there's some amount of, I don't want to say king-making exactly, but you can get to a point where there's a player who basically, you know, based on whatever's happened, how they've played, or maybe just the luck they've gotten, they're very unlikely to win the game, and basically the decisions they make won't meaningfully affect how likely they are to be able to win the game. But it may be that, you know, so this is player, let's call them player D, but what player D's decisions might be that player D will never win the game no matter what, but it might really have a big impact on whether player A or B or C wins the game because they're lowering a particular pile or something like that, right? So that's one thing, is there's this potential for that to kind of quote-unquote mess things up for the other player. And this can particularly be the case if it's, sometimes it's not exactly clear, like, how much is first place versus second place versus third place versus fourth place worth? Like, is getting first place the only thing that matters? Is tying for first with one other person the same as getting first? Is second place better than third place? Is third place better than fourth place? How much better, etc.? And those questions are kind of really hard to work out. Sometimes you can do something if it's a tournament structure where you like you give some points for it, for places. But there's like pros and cons to that. So there's all kinds of mess with that. On top of that, in four-player games, people get attacked more because there's three other players to attack you. So your hands are worse and they do less and are weaker, and people don't like that. People like doing strong things. Additionally, getting attacks yourself is worse because there's three other people who, like if I get a militia, but everyone else had militias, then me getting a militia is less important because everyone else is more likely to already have been attacked by somebody else's militia. Same thing with junking attacks, same thing with most different kinds of attacks. So that's, I guess, more of a difference than something that would make people less happy. The games tend to go shorter in terms of number of turns, which leads to some certain gameplay incentives or disincentives. Leads to kinds of games that people who like two-player games don't like as much. It's harder to get a lot of a particular card, which makes certain kinds of decks harder to build, because sometimes you need more than three, and it's very hard to reliably get more than three of a particular card if it's a good card. So that's a difficulty in four-player games that some people don't like. But probably the biggest thing is, in a four-player game, there's a much lower percentage of the time where it is my turn, because there's three other people who have to take turns. And so it's just a lot longer where I'm in some way not playing, quote-unquote. I'm doing heavy air scare quotes here. And people don't like that. They want to be playing in a higher percentage of the time. So I think that's probably the biggest reason why people who like two-player games play two-player games. But going back to my original point, I think more people like four-player games or play four-player games than actually play with fewer players.
What mistakes do you see otherwise competent players making the most often? I'm going to say it's like playing off of heuristics or like doing things that have worked in the past just because they've worked in the past. Like they learn that X card is good to open with, so they think X card is always good to open with, and when it's out, they open with it, and they don't like think about what it is, or you know, they buy a card because they think it's always good. Like, you know, the culprits are really powerful cards, like things like Scrying Pool, that, you know, are rarely bad, but are sometimes bad, and, you know, people just have this heuristic way of thinking, I think, occasionally, and get those cards without thinking about it.
What's your least favorite board game? My least favorite board game is kind of any board game where you don't have any decision. So I'm thinking Candyland, there's literally zero decision for you to make within the context of the game. Like, you gotta choose what color piece you are, but there's no decision, really. Same thing, card games, War. Can't stand it. There's no decisions. It's completely boring. It's like, let's flip a bunch of cards and see whose card is higher. So I don't like that. There's some other things I don't like in board games, but having no decisions at all is definitely the thing I like the least.
Do you think that Dominion benefits in the long run from perpetual expansions? Or should Dominion be expanded further, more, or has it reached a level of completeness? I am of the opinion that more expansions is never really going to be a bad thing for the game. Dominion was designed really well so that it's pretty much infinitely expansible. You can add more complexity to the game and lots of more mechanics, but you're always going to be limited in the number of those that you see in any given game because you only see, you know, 10 kingdom cards and maybe two landscapey things. So you don't run into problems of just things getting more and more complex as expansions are added. And you also don't run into problems of, you have this entire expansion, but there's one mechanic in it that you don't like or that's not elegant, and now you're stuck with it forever if you want to play, quote, the complete game. No one's forcing you to play with cards you don't like. No one's forcing you to buy expansions you don't like. No one's forcing you to cram all the mechanics and make things more and more complex, even though the totality of all that is Dominion is more more complex than just what you see in one game. So, you know, anyone can stop, and anyone can enjoy as much of the experience as they want, but allowing there to be more of the experience for the competitive nut jobs like myself, and maybe some of the listeners of this podcast, is only an upside. There's an increasing world of Dominion that I certainly don't mind fully exploring, and I feel like, I'll never fully get there.
What is your favorite and your least favorite expansion? I think my favorites are Empires or Renaissance. I can gush about why those are so great, but I think that's been done enough already. I like them for the same reason everyone likes them. They're just really well designed and really interesting. They give you lots of interesting choices. On to the complaining. My least favorite sets are Alchemy and Adventures. And I think they both have the same thing in common that makes me not like them. And that's that they introduce a bunch of, like, flashy mechanics that seem really interesting at first and have a lot of text and different card piles that you get out. And it's, like, trying to trick you into thinking that you're getting more interesting game choices. But really, they just turn this game into, like, an inelegant mesh of mechanics that are swingy, homogenizing garbage.
You often mention the, quote, draw your whole deck, unquote, paradigm as one of the possible strategies. In my experience, that's something that almost never occurs. Do you really see it happen in a lot of the cases? Yeah, absolutely. I see drawing your whole deck as something that happens in a lot of my games. It might be the majority of my games. I'd have to go look and check. But certainly, I think it yes, it does happen in a lot of cases. And if there is draw around, that is a way to increase your hand size without losing an action, particularly if there's a way to do that repeatably. So, like, if you can get a single trusty steed, maybe not so much. But if there's, like, a stack of cards or a couple of stacks of cards that in combination let you do this, so, like, village plus smithy, or some village variant plus some smithy variant, or if there's lab or stables, and particularly if there's some form of thinning around, it's usually good to go for that and to go to a point where you are drawing your whole deck, at least in the two-player games, but very often even with some more players than that. So, yes, absolutely, it's something that I find happens a lot, and it's usually very good to do. There are some exceptions, but usually if you can do it, it's very good to do it.
What advice would you give to a good player trying to get better? I would say spend more time doing that. Now, I would say spend more time analyzing games that you aren't playing at the moment. You could be, like, spectating players who you know are good. Like, I mean, you know, the leaderboard isn't the all end all, but go to the leaderboard and look at players who are near the top. See if you can find them playing games and spectate them. Or just players you know are good. Like, go on YouTube and watch players you know are good and spectate their games. Record your games or rewatch your own games over. Just spend more time thinking about Dominion when you're not playing.